from UALR Public Radio and the Argenta Arts Foundation. This is Tales from the South, recorded in front of a live audience every Tuesday night during dinner at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas. Sit back, relax, and let's reconnect with the power of a story.
Well, they say I've got the gall, and I'm gonna have it all. I was born up in the sky, and I'm never gonna die. How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Bonnie Montgomery? Y'all like Bonnie? Bonnie Montgomery, a native Arkansan, is a composer by day and a honky-tonk queen by night. In addition to her classic country songs, she composed the modern opera, Billy Blythe, about the childhood of Bill Clinton. More can be heard at BonnieMontgomeryMusic.com. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to another edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, both right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Morrell. On my left here, strumming his 1931 National Resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? Our set is designed by Jason Morrell and includes the artwork of V.L. Cox, and tonight's featured artist is painter Doug Norton with his portrait of legendary jazz singer Billie Holiday, which is right here behind me, which is for sale. Our listeners can find out more about this painting and Doug at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern-style storytelling? This week, it's our annual Love Show, and this year, our stories are all about the games people play for love. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who live them. Later tonight, Pat Gillum lays eyes on the love of his life, and nothing is going to stop him. And we'll end the night with J.W. Taylor and his pubescent clandestine love tryst. But let's start the night with Sandra Hamilton as she gets swept off her feet in more ways than one in Creature from Another Planet.
One warm April evening, I stepped out onto my parents' porch barefooted to breathe in the fragrant air, and then stepped into the grass to feel the cool, wet slivers tickle my toes. I was 21, and Dave, whom I recently met through my best friend's boyfriend, Michael, pulled his GTO into the driveway and jumped out with the motor running. He grabbed my arm, swung me toward his cool car while flicking his cool surfer dude bangs to the side, and announced, "We're going for a ride right now and then getting supper." "Well, let me at least get on some shoes and tell my folks," I said, trying to be cool. By that time, Daddy was standing halfway out the front door wearing a scowl. "I'm going for a ride with my friend Dave, Dad. He's a friend of Michael's. Back in a little while." Michael worked summers for my dad and had earned his respect as being reliable and trustworthy. So Dad gave a half-hearted nod as we backed out of the driveway, instantly indicating that Dave was not a suitable caller. He was male. With my awkward living situation, what I saw as giving the information as a courteous guest, my folks saw as asking for permission for parole. I shrugged my shoulders. I jumped in the car shoeless. It was the spring of 1970, and I had found myself accidentally back in my parents' nest. Months earlier, I had come home for a 2-week combination Christmas visit and respite from my fairly new marriage, which had looked really good on paper, but didn't quite pan out in reality. My projected return date went from in 2 weeks to in 2 months, which turned into in 4 months, which turned into never. Since I had returned as a visiting daughter, the transition into returning married but separated daughter had been awkward for all concerned. My parents were terrified, cautious, suspicious, and panicked at my new status as returning about-to-be divorced daughter. In their minds, I now had knowledge. That kind of knowledge. If they could have legally tethered me to the gaslight pole in the front yard, no doubt they would have. To my parents, an apartment was a synonym for dungeon of decadence, and it wasn't possible until things were settled financially. So we lumbered on as weekly. I reverted a couple of years in age, and my parents became increasingly terrified, cautious, suspicious, and panicked. I pulled my door shut and Dave peeled out of the driveway, giving Dad further indication that I was headed down Damnation Road. We pulled into the parking lot of Bruno's Little Italy, rolled down the windows, and took in the glorious aroma of garlic and marinara that was wafting over Southwest Little Rock. "Let's get some pizza," Dave said as he opened his door. "I can't go in like this. I don't have any shoes. They won't allow that." "Just wait here. I'll get us in," he said, simultaneously slamming his door and doing the cool surfer dude hair flick. In the space of 3 minutes, Dave came back with a confident smirk. "We're in. They're fine with it." Aware that in these times, suspicion ran high toward anyone who showed any clothing or behavior tendencies that might smack of hippieism, I had to question how Dave was about to talk a barefoot, jean-wearing young woman into the restaurant. "Oh, I just told them we're traveling from California, and during the night, your suitcase with all of your shoes was stolen." "We came out of our way just to eat at Bruno's because we had heard all the way out in LA how great it is." "Flattery will get you anywhere. Let's go." We were greeted at the door by an anxious maitre d' who was anxious to prove the establishment's West Coast reputation was correct. He waved toward the other side of the room, and immediately a basket of warm garlic bread appeared on the table. We ate our way through the huge mound while we watched Mr. Bruno toss pizzas behind the glass kitchen window. Suddenly, Dave pushed the now empty bread basket aside and announced, "I'm stuffed and I don't have any money, and besides, it's complimentary. Let's go." Again, he grabbed my arm and the rest of me was obligated to follow. We jumped back into the GTO, raced down Asher Avenue to University. Soon we found ourselves sitting on the bank of the Arkansas River, gazing at a sandbar illuminated by a full moon. I was now both amused and fascinated by this spontaneous, attractive, average Joe pseudo-surfer dude. He leaned back on his elbows. "You know, last time I was down here a couple of months ago, I was looking at that sandbar and a UFO came from nowhere and hovered over for about 5 minutes, landed, and then a strange-looking guy got out for a minute, stood there, and got back in. Then it took off and disappeared." This news had been delivered as casually as if he were telling me about his last trip to buy new socks. "Oh, you're just pulling my leg," I said with a nervous giggle. Certainly, he was just trying to make conversation, trying to make me laugh. No one says something like that for real, especially on the first date. Then I looked into his eyes and saw absolute conviction. I felt my breath catch in my throat. "No, it happened. It's true. I swear on my grandmother's grave." He was not kidding. And for the first time since I ended up back at my parents' house, I wished that I had been as cautious and suspicious of men as they were. I began to squirm, digging my toes in and out of the sand. Then I jumped up and dusted myself off, trying to appear and sound casual. Well, guess I should go. Need to go job hunting tomorrow. Sure had fun. We filled the air in the GTO with talk of our mutual friends on the 10-minute drive home. The car had barely stopped moving when I hopped out, waved, and yelled, "Been fun, sure had fun," licking my dry lips and wiping my sweaty palms on my jeans. I bolted into the house, happy to hear the voices of my terrified, cautious, suspicious, and panicked parents asking simultaneously, "Where have you been?" "Just had a little Italian food," I replied, and then added under my breath, "On a whole nother planet."
Sandra Spots Hamilton, a designer and writer, is a graduate of the University of Arkansas with a degree in art and a minor in English. She was born and currently lives in Little Rock, Arkansas, planet Earth. In our next story, Pat Gillum isn't going to let anything deter him from love in The Summer of My Broken Heart.
I slumped way down in the seat as I drove down Main Street in Watson, Arkansas. Well, actually, the street. It was dark, but it was not nearly dark enough. It's a well-known fact at my college, Arkansas A&M, 25 miles away, that one just did not venture into Watson alone after dark. Watson had three or four really bad young dudes. They loved to fight, and they were good at it. Stories were told of one average-looking guy who had mastered the art of getting in three running steps and throwing the first punch in a one-punch fight. Usually against much bigger guys. But I had a date with Barbara Sue Donahoe, and nothing or nobody was going to stop me. I'd met Barbara 2 days earlier at the Delta Dip in Dumas, home of the Ding Dong Daddy. I didn't make that last part up. It's just what they say down there in the Delta. I was finishing up my student teaching in Dumas. I'd just gotten my hamburger and was walking back to my car. A guy I knew from Arkansas A&M was talking to a carload of high school girls. I looked in, I saw a couple of nice-looking girls in the car, but in the back seat, far side, I saw her. I almost dropped my hamburger. There, before my eyes, sat the most beautiful one-eyed girl I had ever seen. Her hairstyle covered up one eye, but a little later, I saw the other one too, and it was every bit as beautiful as the first one. Man, this was it. This was the girl I wanted to marry. But you see, I had this problem. Every time I met a girl I really liked, I just froze up. I just couldn't think of a single sensible thing to say. In college, when I found a girl I really liked, I sometimes called her up and said something like, "Hey, you wouldn't want to go out with me, would you?" Then, if she hesitated, even for a second, I threw in the clincher. "I don't blame you. I wouldn't either if I were you. Bye." Well, you can kind of see my situation here, looking at this girl that I wanted to marry. But this girl was so bubbly, so outgoing, and so friendly, she just would not allow me to freeze up. Before long, I had a date with her for Saturday night. Following her directions, I headed for Watson that Saturday night, tried to be as inconspicuous as I could as I rolled down Main Street. I finally made it through town, breathing easier now, and headed out a winding gravel road 3 miles out through the cotton fields to her house. When I arrived, Barbara invited me in. Her two squirmy little sisters whispered and laughed at each other about how tall I was, how big my hands were, and would you just take a look at those feet? Her brother, J.D., about my age, was there with his wife and baby. He shook my hand and all, but the look in his eye was anything but friendly. It wasn't until years later that I began to piece it all together from his stories about his three running steps technique that I began to realize J.D. was the one I'd heard stories about. Little did I know, the real danger was not on the streets of Watson, but here, in this house, looking at me hard. But his mom and daddy were there, so things went well that night. We got to date a few times, then student teaching was over, and I was off to my new teaching job at St. Paul, Arkansas. I went to see Barbara every weekend I could, which meant every weekend I was invited. But she was busy finishing up her senior year in high school. St. Paul was a long way off, and I didn't get to see her as much as I wanted to that semester. At the end of the school year, Barbara was headed off to A&M to start to college. I knew Barbara would be making a big splash there that summer. Pretty girls like her always do. So I decided to go to Oklahoma, work on a pipeline, make a little money. I knew Barbara still had ties to some guy in the Air Force and was not quite ready to put all her eggs in one basket yet, but we parted on good terms, each having no hold on the other. Well, about midsummer, I stuck my gloved hand into a block and tackle on that pipeline job, and the last inch of my thumb just stayed in that glove. I went over and told the foreman, who had caused this accident in the first place, that I had lost a thumb. He cussed me out really good for messing up his safety record. My Oklahoma adventure was over, and I was headed back to Arkansas. I drove down to see Barbara in summer school at A&M. As I expected, she was making a big splash. Pretty personable girls just tend to do that. Well, she was dating a football star, the son of the new head football coach, who was making his own splash, and she still had ties to the Air Force dude, but she seemed to be, in talking with me, to be leaving the door open for us just a little bit. I suddenly decided I'd best go back to school that second summer term, pick up some chemistry. So right before I left to go back to A&M, I wrote Barbara. Told her that I had met her football jock, and he seemed to think he was pretty wonderful. She wrote back and said she had decided he was pretty wonderful, too. And another thing or two along that same line of thought. Buddy, that hit me, and it hit me hard. Here I was, I'd already paid my tuition money, and I was getting the royal shaft. So after a couple of my hardest days ever, I decided to go back to school anyway, as hard as that would be. I never liked to just throw away money. To make matters worse, I got a job working in the cafeteria where Barbara also worked. My old pals tried to cheer me up. It didn't work. My buddy Sam, a one-legged guy, offered to fight him for me since I was thumb incapacitated. I was kind of hard to cheer up, seeing her all cozied up with him every day. Well, one day when we were working, Barbara asked me if I would take her to church that night. I thought a while, maybe a second, and I told her, well, I don't see why not. I was in a really good mood right up until I saw them right out in front of my dorm, hugging and carrying on. I think he brought her over there to put on a show for me. Well, that didn't help my mood much, and I was pretty cool to her at church. When I pulled her up to her dorm after church, the jock was waiting. He came storming up. I knew I wasn't in good fighting trim, thumb cut off and all. Actually, I have never been a good fighter, thumb or no thumb. It turns out he did all the fighting with his words, all aimed right at her, right there in front of me. Barbara very nicely listened to everything he had to say, let him just rant himself out, ending up with, "You either leave with me right now or it's over." She just looked at him and very nicely said, "It's already over." They say the meek shall inherit the earth. Well, that night I began inheriting the part of it I most wanted, Barbara. We got married on December 26th of that year and headed off to New Orleans. We got lost somewhere in South Louisiana, and I couldn't understand those Cajuns' directions at all. And we never could find New Orleans. But somehow, it just didn't seem to matter at the time.
Pat Gillum and his wife, Barbara, married 46 years, have 2 children and 5 grandchildren. Pat's blog, foreverahillbilly.blogspot.com, has readers from 52 countries. His book, Spreading Wing, is available now on Amazon.com and Amazon Europe. In our final story of the night, J.W. Taylor explores teenage love games in a very interesting locale in The Confession.
It was 1 a.m. when Brother Benji set me and Dana McDuffie down in his office. I could feel Dana's eyes on me, and Brother Benji's too, but I focused on the cross on the wall behind his desk and tried to breathe. "You kids have 2 options, Brother Benji said. "Option number 1 is I pick up that phone, call your parents, tell them to come and get you, and I'll let you explain why." He could have stopped there. Because hear me, brothers and sisters, I didn't care if it meant being stripped naked, dipped in honey, and rolled in fire ants while singing all 6 verses of Amazing Grace. I was going with option number 2. I knew Brother Benji wasn't going to kill me and bury me in the backyard. I wasn't so sure about Mama. I was 14, and it was the summer of 1985, the night of the youth lock-in at Calvary Baptist in Shreveport, Louisiana. For the teenagers, a church lock-in was a stay-up-as-late-as-you-like extravaganza, a night away from home with movies, music, pizza, games, and a bit of hair pulling with the occasional slap fight. For the parents, it was even better. With a promise to pick them up at 8 the next morning, they began dropping their darlings off at 6 p.m., and by 6:15, the church parking lot was enveloped in a thick black fog smelling suspiciously of burning rubber. The man in charge of the 40-plus teenagers was Brother Benji, the youth minister, who was an angry little man with slumped shoulders, a squatty face, thick glasses, and the joyful spirit of someone under a perpetual IRS audit. He had shooed us into the fellowship hall and led us in prayer before outlining the rules which no one in the room intended to follow. Then he turned us loose. I grabbed some pizza and talked to some friends, all while watching Dana McDuffie. For weeks, Dana and I had been engaged in that time-honored teenage courtship ritual of circling each other like feral cats, staring and preening, puffing, neither willing to make the first move. Feats of strength and fluttered lashes, a bicep flex and a hair flip. Cologne and perfume applied in such copious amounts that we could smell one another through walls. It was all prelude in preparation for tonight. I had decided tonight was the night. But I was nervous. I was new to the game of love, and Dana had what we in the evangelical community called a reputation. And unlike leprosy or rickets, you couldn't take vitamin D or rub some aloe vera on a reputation and make it all better. But I didn't care. I had decided. So around midnight, when I caught Dana alone coming out of the girls' bathroom, I made my move. Wanna talk? That was my move. I had practiced it for weeks in the mirror. But then Dana blindsided me. Talk about what? Now, if my move had been a ship, they'd have been ringing bells and handing out life jackets because there was 6 foot of water in a boiler room. In my practice mirror sessions, Dana had always responded either yes or no. I was woefully unprepared for her to answer my question with a question. So I just stood there in the wreckage of my move, the smell of my own sweat and a half bottle of Stetson burning my nostrils. Dana gave me kind of a sideways look, like the RCA dog. And then she smiled and grabbed my hand, and we ran through a side door into the church courtyard. We found another open door, and she led me up some stairs and down some others until eventually we arrived in the elementary Sunday school wing. At the end of a long hall, we opened the door to the first grade classroom. I turned on the light. She turned it off. Shortly thereafter, we commenced to sinning. Now, I may have been new to the game of love, but it didn't take me long to figure out that we weren't playing the same game. Dana was playing bridge and chess and backgammon all at the same time. I was hitting rocks with hammers. Yet, just about the time I was learning how to hold my own, I was blinded by a bright light, not unlike what I imagine Saul experienced on the road to Damascus. Only instead of God's voice, I heard Brother Benji's. To this day, I don't know how he found us, or how he even knew we were missing. But he had caught us at play on the fields of love, and he promptly called the game on account of darkness in our souls. And so we walked that long green mile back to his office. He sat us down and shut the door. He took off his thick glasses and tossed them on his desk. Then he rubbed his wee little face. And then he rubbed it again. I looked at her. She looked at me. Silence. "You should be ashamed," he said. "Ashamed. This is God's house, a place of worship, and you two have turned it into a den of iniquity." And thus began an impromptu sermon on the evils of the flesh. As he spoke, I was struck by two almost simultaneous revelations. One, for the first time in my life, I was a fornicator. Two, I should not have been quite so happy about it. I had committed a real, live, grown-up sin, and it was all I could do to keep the smile in my heart from reaching my face. But my parents didn't take me to church every Wednesday and twice on Sundays for nothing. My temporary euphoria was slowly replaced by the cold and creeping feeling that now, after 14 years, all 10 of the commandments were suddenly in play. Instead of just keeping the Sabbath holy and honoring my mom and dad, now I had to watch out for coveting my neighbor's wife and his ox and his donkey, along with bearing false witness, whatever that was, and murdering and thieving and adultery. A whole new world was opening up, and I was afraid it was going to swallow me whole. "Are you listening?" Brother Benji said. "Yes, sir." And so he gave us our options. A phone call igniting a parental apocalypse, or option number two. And it came to pass that option number two led us back to the fellowship hall, to a small raised stage in the front of the room, the congregation before us, Brother Benji behind us. And in a loud voice, Brother Benji did say, "J.W. Taylor, confess before your peers and your God." And lo, I froze. Never had 40-plus teenagers been so quiet. The whole scene seemed like a photograph or still life. No one was moving except me. And as bad as I was shaking on the outside, it was worse on the inside. Voices and laws and rules and commandments were swirling in my head. Love and lust and heaven and hell all blurred together until I couldn't figure out what I needed to confess because I couldn't keep track of all my sins. "J.W., the voice said. Dana took my hand. Her hand was as warm as mine was cold. I took a deep, shaky breath and said, "Me and Dana went to the Sunday school rooms and kissed and stuff." The voice, "And what you did was wrong, wasn't it?" "Yes, sir." "And you won't do it again, will you?" "No, sir." Dana let go of my hand. And again, the voice. Dana McDuffie, confess before your peers and your God. And then it happened. Dana took two steps forward to the front and center of that stage, and she confessed, and confessed, and confessed. She confessed in such vivid and salacious detail that Brother Benji tried to keep her from confessing anymore. But she only confessed louder. And the louder she confessed, the smaller Brother Benji became until he receded completely into the background of the great passion play that was unfolding before him. And the more she confessed about what had transpired in that first grade Sunday school room, the more I began to wonder whether I'd even been there. It was a tour de force of repentance. And when Dana finally finished her stem whining confession, the wee little man behind her didn't ask if what she had done was wrong or if she was going to do it again. He just stepped down off the stage and walked right out the doors of the fellowship hall, leaving me and Dana and our peers and our God to figure out what to do next. When I woke up later that morning, Dana was gone. My parents picked me up, and I rode home in silence. I went to bed and slept another 6 hours without dreaming a single dream. I never saw Dana McDuffie inside the walls of Calvary Baptist Church again. But I saw her again the next Friday night, and the one after that, and the one after that.
J.W. Taylor is an Arkansas native living in Little Rock with his wife, Jennifer, and daughters, Elizabeth and Catherine. He skipped writing his first and second novels and is currently working on not writing his third. So how about our story and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers, thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Stitcher Smart Radio, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. We are currently open for submissions from Southerners. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Writer accommodations provided by Robinwood Bed and Breakfast. More at robinwoodbnb.com. Experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. Schedule and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.